Good evening. Welcome to this evening's Schwemm Lecture with Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, Christopher Hill. We'd like to give a special welcome to the various media representatives here from Japan. Thank you for coming. My name is Paul Sorrentino. I am the coordinator for the Schwemm Fund and Director of Religious Life at Amherst College. Jack Schwemm and his wife Nancy established the Schwemm Fund to expose the campus community to articulate scholars, intellectuals, and public figures who reason and act with high ethical standards. He believes that a heightened sense of ethics is critically important to the future viability and welfare of the United States as a free democratic society. A portion of the Amherst College mission states that we are committed to educating men and women to engage the world around them and lead principled lives of consequence. Ambassador Hill has spent his entire career as a diplomat in the State Department doing precisely that, engaging the world around him and leading a principled life of consequence. He has consistently acted with integrity and moral courage so that he has gained the respect and trust of people from Eastern Europe to East Asia. After graduating from Bowdoin College, he served for 2 years with the Peace Corps in Cameroon. He was appointed to his first ambassadorship in Macedonia under the Clinton administration. He served later ambassadorships in Poland and South Korea. Currently, he serves as the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs and is the lead negotiator for the six-party talks on North Korea nuclear disarmament. Ambassador Hill received the State Department's Distinguished Service Award for his work on the Bosnia Peace Settlement. He was given the Robert S. Fraser Award for Peace Negotiations for his work on the Kosovo Crisis. This past July, the New York Times published an editorial piece that made a rather transparent allusion to a popular wrist bracelet. It was entitled, "What Would a Diplomat Do?" The concluding paragraph suggests that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice would do well in considering Middle East strategy to start by asking, what would Chris Hill do? Our speaker tonight is well qualified to address us in the ethics of diplomacy, conscience, and pragmatism in foreign affairs. Let me mention at the outset that after his talk, there'll be a period of time for question and answer from the audience. And then we'll be taking a break, and after the break, we'll invite questions from the media. So we're just going to make that separation for questions. So would you please welcome Ambassador Christopher Hill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It is a great honor, a great pleasure to be here in Amherst College. I confess I haven't been here since about the spring of 1974 when I was playing lacrosse for Bowdoin and we came here for a game. I looked up the score the other day and I'm sorry to report to you that we won. But it's also a great pleasure to see Paul Sorrentino. Now, Paul and I go way back because we not only went to the same high school together, Moses Brown School in Providence, Rhode Island, but we played on the same lacrosse team and we were actually on the same midfield. So, after lacrosse, you go on to different pursuits, but I think Paul is the only one who went on to be a director of religious life. Paul, somehow you got through that lacrosse experience without too much violence in you. We were having a discussion earlier about whether he ever committed a penalty or not. And I thought he was guilty of slashing at one point, but apparently not. It's great to see you here. And I also want to thank Paul, in fact, is the coordinator of the Schwemm Fund for this opportunity to come here and speak at this very distinguished college. I mean, a college that I can say to you, who probably already know it, but I'll also say to the Japanese media, is truly one of our finest educational institutions in the country and one that I think every American can be very proud of. We had, I've had some opportunity today to go to one of the classes here, actually a history class on the post-Cold War history, and also have had a chance to meet some of the students and to talk to them about the potential for, you know, what careers are like in the State Department and what are what we can, what needs to be done, what can be accomplished. And so I must say, when I get this opportunity not only to get out of Washington but to get to a place like this, I feel pretty good about the direction that our country is going in, because I sense among the students I was talking to a real interest in public service careers and in particular diplomatic careers, because I think there's a lot our country is going to need to do. It has been, you know, this post-Cold War period has indeed been a very, very tough time for our country. Certainly, to serve as a diplomat, to explain to a world that in some case doesn't understand us, in another case doesn't like us, it's been very important to explain what we're trying to do and to make sure that the world understands that the United States is very much committed to an internationalist future. To be sure, we are a very large country with enormous responsibilities, but I think we're a country that, in carrying out those responsibilities, we have a pretty long track record, and we've carried out those responsibilities as responsibility of wielding power, but doing it in a way that I think Americans can be proud of our contribution to the world. And I think anybody who has been abroad, who's gone to countries that have not been as blessed as our country, will soon realize the inspiration that we have been for so many people. I will never forget arriving in Albania, a small, impoverished country in the Balkans, whose American diplomats left in 1946. Three diplomats going off in a boat from the port of Durres, and we were never back again until 1991. And when we got there and moved into our embassy, and I remember I found an Albanian woman whose husband had worked for us in the 1940s and had been executed as soon as our diplomats had left, and I had her raise the flag that day. And she came up to me, and she was in her 80s, and she put her finger on my chest and said, "Don't you ever leave us again." And I remember thinking that there was a case where, you know, we need to understand the importance people attach to us. And so when people are upset with us, disappointed with us, I think we need to understand it in a positive term. They expect so much from us. They look for us to do things. They really look for us to lead. And so we do have this very important role, and it behooves us to carry it out in a way that reflects the authority, the strength of our country, but also the values of this country. You know, I was talking earlier with this class about, you know, when did the United States become a sort of value-laden foreign policy? Was it just recently? And in fact, when you look at our history, when you go back even to people who first settled this country in the 17th century, but also in the 19th century, I mean, you see a country whose people do have a strong belief in values. And so you look at how our missionaries went forth in the 19th century and founded places like Robert College in Istanbul or American University in Beirut, places like that. You can see that we have been talking about American values and making that a centerpiece of our engagement abroad. And to some extent, this activity, which went on very much in the 19th century, was kind of interrupted by this very brutal century, the 20th century, where there were two world wars and you know, a long and bitter Cold War, where there was the use of nuclear weapons for the first and, God forbid, for the last time, that this foreign policy characterized by our values had to some extent during that century given way to a foreign policy that was much more conditioned by the need for stability, by the need for taking care of very tough issues, especially during that Cold War, a foreign policy where we tried to make sure that countries, if nothing else good happened, they at least stayed quiet. They didn't move to the other camp to become Soviet satellites, to use that term. And so it was in a way a kind of unusual century for our country. And now, certainly starting, I think, with the demise of the Soviet Union, the demise of the Cold War, we once again, I think, are back in touch with those values. And I think what we now need to do is to use these values to make clear what our beliefs are, but at the same time, I think use some of the pragmatism we had from this period, and to understand that as we deal with countries, the world is not quite the 19th century. It's a very different place. And so we have to be very careful as we encourage countries in a certain direction. I would argue we should encourage by example, by setting an example of what our country has been able to do with such very bedrock values as human rights, and to make sure that as we press other countries to accept human rights, that our real trump card in this is is our own track record of protecting human rights. And I think to a great extent we are succeeding with that. But I think we live in a very challenged time. We live in a time when the speed of events is so fast, and our ability to react to so many challenges is itself a great challenge. So I think we need to maybe develop a better sense of patience with some countries that have not lived up to what we want to see them do. But at the same time, I think we have to be clear what our views are and express those views in a way that will make the situation better. So when I think of, or when Paul gave me this this tough topic of ethics and diplomacy, I did think about the fact, I gave it a lot of thought, about the fact that we cannot put ourselves in the position of where we were earlier on in this century, in the 20th century, where we valued stability above all else. We need to try to take that stability and come up with a hybrid by which we understand the importance of stability, but at the same time, we also understand that how countries behave internally can also affect stability not only of the of that particular country, but also of the region. So here we have to, I think, work with countries and understand that for many countries, being confronted by the United States over an issue is a very frightening experience. They see us as a very powerful country, often dwarfing their own country, and they feel that the response should be, on their part, a kind of feisty belligerence toward us. And so I think we need to be looking for ways to express the values that, first of all, show off our experiences more than anything, but also look for things that are achievable, and not just things that make us feel better in expressing the values, but things that can actually cause a change in those countries. At times in the Balkans, certainly through the 1990s, it was a very frustrating time indeed to see a part of the world which so many of us, including myself, had such fond memories. You know, my dad was a Foreign Service officer. I lived in Belgrade from when I was 5, 6, 7 years old. I came back in my 20s when Belgrade was still a very special place with Tito there. And then to see the terrible what had happened to it, I realized that I couldn't be nostalgic for the previous Yugoslavia that I knew. I had to deal with the reality of Yugoslavia as it was emerging. And I always felt that as we looked at the situation in the Balkans in the 1990s, that it was, to some extent, it's true there was this Manichaean issue of good and evil and the need to confront evil. But I think there was also very much the need to understand, if not confront, the forces of history. 1990s Yugoslavia was in very, very much a reflection of the late 19th century in the Balkans. Indeed, I think as we emerged from the Cold War period, we suddenly realized that all our political science textbooks had actually become history textbooks. And curiously enough, our history textbooks had become political science textbooks, because what we were seeing in the 1990s was very much the history of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and its replacement by national states in the Balkans. And so I think to some extent we made mistakes in those terms. We tended to look for villains, which they're usually villains to find, but we also looked for good guys, and sometimes those are harder to find. And so I think we, rather than understand these factors as a force of history, and historical facts can only be undone at a very slow pace, we kind of rushed in and we thought things could be easily fixed. I say rushed in because in many respects we let things fester and we were not active enough. But in other respects, we rushed to judgment about the circumstances there. And so I think we are still dealing with a very tough situation in the Balkans. As many of you know, we are expecting Kosovo to declare itself an independent state at some point in the near future. But I think as we go through this, we need to respect the history. We need to respect why people feel the way they do, apart from thinking that so-and-so is bad and so-and-so is good, and try to deal with that, and try to deal with it in a way that we can create communities and we can help people work with each other and understand that there are communities to be forged. You know, as I deal with North Korea today, there are a lot of reasons to be very pessimistic about the situation. After all, North Korea is a country that has really shut itself off from the world. It has, looked for ways to be as belligerent as possible to everybody. And yet, I think we are confronted with some facts that make it very difficult to deal with this problem. That is, a country that doesn't like to listen, that certainly doesn't like to be directly threatened in any way, that uses threats in order to justify their own hardline policies. So we have to look for ways to make progress, and I think at all times you have to keep your eye on the ball. What are you trying to accomplish? Are you trying to feel good by denouncing North Korea? Or are you trying to look for ways to get North Korea to give up these nuclear weapons? I felt it was very important to look for a way to deal with the to keep our eye on the ball, that is, get the nuclear weapons. But I realized that we weren't going to do it all at once. You have a country that has really made a decision, not that the decision-making is in any way democratic, but you have a country that's been engaged in nuclear weapons and building nuclear weapons for some 30 years. So the question was, how do you get them to step away from it? And I think, like a lot of things in life, you realize that they're not going to wake up one morning and say, we've had enough of these nuclear weapons. They're going to do it on a step-by-step basis. They're going to kind of move a half step, look around, say, well, this isn't so bad, and then move another half step. And we hope that in these continued steps that we will actually make some progress. I think with respect to the negotiations, we also made, I think, a very important decision, which was that as we deal with this very difficult security problem posed by North Korea's possession of nuclear weapons, we should also deal with some of the causes of this. And one of the causes, I think, one of the causes, is the failure over the decades and even centuries to develop a sense of community in Northeast Asia. And so, in going forward, we felt it was necessary to not just make this a U.S.-North Korea problem, because after all, there are other countries that also have an important stake in having North Korea not go nuclear, Japan being one, China being another, and South Korea being still another. So together with these countries, as well as Russia, we put together something called a six-party process and have tried to deal with this on a multilateral basis. Now, as anyone who knows diplomacy, it's tough enough to talk to one other guy in the room, but when you have six people in the room, it's very difficult to do. And yet, I think this is, despite the frustrations, this is the way forward. We worked very hard with the North Koreans, first to get them to shut down their nuclear facility that was continuing to operate and continuing to produce plutonium. And it took a long time, but on July 15th, they agreed to shut it down. And in return for that, we gave them some heating, some so-called heavy fuel oil, HFO, which is used for heating and used in certain industrial facilities. Not a lot of heating fuel, with the understanding that if they want to get more fuel, they need to go deeper into denuclearization. That is, just shutting down the reactor isn't going to do the trick. So we agreed last February, after some lengthy discussions, lengthy negotiations, that for an additional tranche of heating fuel, they would agree to shut down, not only shut down, but to disable the facility. And in addition to that, by the end of calendar year 07, they would provide to us a list of all of their nuclear programs. Well, that deadline came and went, and we have a mixed picture that has emerged. First of all, with respect to North Korea shutting down and disabling the nuclear facilities, they've done a pretty good job. They've actually, Yongbyon nuclear facility, that's Yongbyon, which there's a Yongbyon in South Korea, which is a ski resort. This is a different Yongbyon. Has really been shut down and disabling work is underway. Now people say, well, how do you know they're really disabling it? And the answer is Americans are actually there on the scene doing the job. So when we know that the reverse cooling loop has been severed and is left rusting on the ground, we know that because Americans did it. And so things have moved along on the Yongbyon facility, and I think what's most important to us is the fact that, unlike in the 1990s, where there was an agreement at least to shut it down, though not to try to disable it, that is, break it, but just to shut it down, unlike in that period when there was ongoing regular maintenance, there has not been maintenance done to the Yongbyon facility, which means that the disabling of it combined with a lack of maintenance really shows, I think, that we have a strategic understanding with the North Koreans that we're not going back to producing plutonium. And it was a tough thing to get them to agree to. It was done with a lot of face-to-face encounters. It was done in six-party process. It was done bilaterally. It was done really by lengthy talks. And so the next thing that we have been concerned about is, since the year 2002, the North Koreans, or earlier than 2002, I should say, we saw that the North Koreans were making purchases of equipment and materials very much consistent with the other way of making a nuclear weapon, and that is uranium enrichment. And so we have been really pressing the North Koreans for a to tell us about the uranium enrichment program. And indeed, in 2002, that was the reason the U.S. pulled out of a previous agreement with the North Koreans, because they refused to acknowledge it. Well, finally, we did get the North Koreans to acknowledge that one of the main elements of their uranium enrichment program, which were these aluminum tubes which would be used to construct centrifuges, and as you know, you need something like 2,000 or 3,000 centrifuges. And we've seen that these tubes are not being used for the centrifuge program, and we've had American diplomats go and look at this aluminum that was used and see what they're actually using it for. We actually had American diplomats, people like myself, carry this aluminum back in their suitcases to verify that this is the precise aluminum that we knew that the North Koreans had actually purchased for this purpose. And so what has emerged is the fact that they are not using it for uranium enrichment. So if they have a uranium enrichment program, they must be getting the aluminum somewhere else, and we have absolutely no information that they've succeeded in doing that. So we believe, on the way toward ruling out that they have any that they have developed a uranium enrichment capability such that they can have fissile material from such a program. So as we got to the end of December, we needed them to give a full declaration of their nuclear activities. And this is really part of the deal that they need to fulfill. And on the one hand, they've done very well on the disabling of the reactor, as I mentioned. It's not entirely finished, but things have moved very well. On uranium enrichment, they've made a beginning in terms of explaining to us what they did with some of this, but they have refused to acknowledge that they ever had a uranium enrichment program, and we need to continue to work with them on that. In addition, we have detected over recent months that they've had some long-standing cooperation with Syria, and we would like them to tell us more about what they've been doing. We know a lot of things, but we want to see them tell us what they've been up to. They have pledged not to have any foreign cooperation on nuclear, on any type of nuclear energy, or nuclear weapons programs, but we would like to hear what they've done in the past. So we are not there yet with the declaration that we need. And so a lot of people say, well, you know, December 31 came and passed. They didn't give you the declaration. Why don't you walk away from the six-party talks? And I would ask you, is that a good idea? Is that in our interest to walk away from the six-party talks? I don't think it is. I think our interests are such that we should stay with this and keep working this and see if we can get to the end of this. If we can get through this phase where they give us this full declaration, then we will move on to a very important last phase, and that is not only to disable the nuclear reactor, but actually to dismantle it, carry parts, critical parts away. We will also look for ways to see if we can help retrain some of their nuclear scientists to do other things besides make nuclear bombs. We will also, in this final phase, create the basis for a U.S. Official relations with North Korea, and we will in addition to that be prepared to put a proposal for a peace settlement on the Korean Peninsula on the table, and to try to negotiate a peace proposal that would replace the current armistice, which is kind of an elaborate ceasefire, with a permanent peace proposal. Finally, we will put on the table a proposal for a Northeast Asia peace and security mechanism, a way to make permanent this sense of neighborhood in Northeast Asia, a Northeast Asia peace and security mechanism that will begin with the six parties, but also be buttressed by other countries that want to join this. None of this, however, none of the above will be possible if the North Koreans don't do what they have to do, which is to give up the plutonium that they've already produced from the reactor. And they're supposed to give us a full figure on that, which will be in the neighborhood of 30, 40 kilos, something like that. When they give up that, all of that nuclear material, when they have the reactor not only disabled as it is, but actually dismantled, when they come clean on what uranium enrichment activities there have been and where it stands now, again, we've taken some positive steps there. We need more. I think we can look to seeing if we can end this very difficult chapter of nuclear proliferation in Northeast Asia. We've got a very tough year 08 ahead of us on this. We're already behind. As we have a team going into North Korea, they should be landing in a couple of hours, led by the Foreign Service officer named Sung Kim, who will be talking to the North Koreans to see whether we can get from them the complete declaration that will allow us to move forward, because they've asked for us to do some things, including taking them off a list of countries that are treated as enemies with respect to trade. It's called Trading with the Enemies Act, kind of a quaint name from 1862. We need to, we will have some obligations, but we need them to take their obligations as well. I don't know if we can get to the end of this. I cannot guarantee any favorable solution, but what I can tell you is that as we've worked together in the six-party process, our relationship with China has improved as a result of this, of working shoulder to shoulder with the Chinese, who are actually the chair of the six-party process, working on a practical issue with the Chinese. And I think we've been able to have a better understanding with the Chinese. We have worked very closely with our allies, Japan and South Korea. And I think in that process, while Japan and South Korea have had some rocky times together in the last few years, the six-party process was an area where Japan and South Korea were able to work together. And we look forward to that actually expanding and improving in the years ahead. So I think the six-party process, even if it hasn't achieved the goal yet of getting North Korea to give up its nuclear ambitions, has achieved a broader goal, which is trying to get states in the region to work better together and to be good neighbors. I like to think that our position in it has been the right approach. We are one of six. We are not some leader of the pack. I spend as much time listening, more time listening than I do talking, which I think is always a good sign in diplomacy. You tend to learn more when you listen. I think we have also established in the region a sense that the United States really cares and is prepared to deal with all the other countries in a mood of mutual respect. And so I think it's the way to go. But again, there are no guarantees in life and certainly no guarantees in diplomacy. But I think the United States should not fear to have diplomacy. I think diplomacy is the way that we can pursue our interests in the world. Obviously, diplomacy doesn't work in all circumstances, and we know where those circumstances have been in the past. And but it ought to be the first recourse and not the last. So I think we can feel a little better about getting working through this. I would say our relations in Asia as a result of this are not too bad. And I think if we keep at this, really keep at it, we can do, I think, one of the most important things, which is to end this terrible tragedy on the Korean Peninsula. I think it's very important that Americans understand that when Korea was divided on the Korean Peninsula, it was through no fault of Koreans. It was done by foreigners, and we were part of it. I mean, I think we did the right thing, because otherwise we would have had Russian troops taking the surrender of Japanese troops in the entire peninsula, not just in the area north of the 38th parallel. So I think we did the right thing to ensure that our troops would be there. But it is a great tragedy to see this country of Korea divided through no fault of its own. And so when Americans are kind of critical of Koreans, of wanting to do too much in terms of reaching out to North Korea, I think we have to be respectful of the history there. So I think a combination of pragmatism, but understanding what our essential goals are, what our values are, what we need to see achieved, and I think we will be just fine as a country. So I look forward to seeing some Amherst students dial up that Foreign Service exam on their computers, and if you don't pass it the first time, take it again, because it is free. And if you don't pass the second time, take it a third time. So I think the record, by the way, is 10 times. And I wish I could remember the guy who did that, but he's actually done quite well in the Foreign Service. So I hope you'll look at this type of career in the Foreign Service. And why don't I go to questions now?
Thank you.
So, Paul, you want me to just call them out myself?
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm a senior here, so I'm going to ask take a little liberty and ask two questions.
Well, you figure you won't get expelled at this point? It happens in the second semester.
One is kind of a career question.
Yeah.
More personal for you.
Yeah.
The first one is, what role, if any, do you get to play in formulating the actual policy?
Yeah.
That Washington espouses as a diplomat on the ground?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, first of all, on the policy issue, I'm the assistant secretary, so I play a lot of. I have an important role to play in it right now, and I work very closely with Secretary Rice, who is really the brains of this operation, and has really been the one to say we need to get this thing solved. So she has worked very closely with the president. And so I have great support, strategic support from our leadership to get this thing done. Now, one thing you like when you're the negotiator is a lot of flexibility. You don't like to have, be put in the position of a North Korean negotiator where you have to phone home all the time. So you like to have enough running room to make decisions on the fly. And I have a sense of where the secretary is on these issues. So if I feel I've gone out a little ahead, I'll do that. And then I'll say to my interlocutor, I need to phone home on that, but I think I can sell it. So what's important is to let your negotiator do his or her job. And the secretary, Secretary Rice, lets me do my job. It's very, very important to me. It's funny, when we're talking about a big issue like Korea negotiations, I mean, these are things where literally our president will be looking at the drafts of agreements. So these are done at a very, very senior level. I can make recommendations, but the decisions are made at a senior level. But don't forget that I'm assistant secretary for other parts of Asia, and so often there are decisions I make and basically no one else will see. So what is a policy decision? Is a policy decision whether to attend a funeral for the former Indonesian President Suharto, whether to send a funeral delegation? You might say, no, that's below the level of policy. Actually, it can be policy, that sort of thing. So my office would be involved in that. And what I try to do is, like, let's say we have an issue in, Cambodia or something, and we have some tough situation there at times. We have a Cambodian government that at times has been very challenged to do the right thing on some human rights issues, political prisoners, etc. As I figure out how to handle this, because it really stops with me. I mean, I'm not going to pull the secretary into this. I'll ask the Cambodia desk officer, who might be 28 years old, 30 years old, and I'll ask the desk officer, what should we do here? And the desk officer says, well, I think we ought to try this, and I'll ask a few questions. Desk officer defends her position really well, and I'll say, okay, let's do it. And let's inform the secretary that we're doing this. So who just did the policy there? Probably that, that 28-year-old Cambodia desk officer. Now, do I ask every desk officer what do they think? As a management tool, it'd be a nice thing, but frankly speaking, you run out of time. So I ask the ones that I think can really make a contribution. So it means you should be on your toes. No matter what job you have, be on your toes. Be ready to brief well on something. I always remember when I started my job as a Balkan director, the office director, and Holbrooke hired me on it was a frenzied moment where he hired me, and I went to New York with him 2 days later, and we met Secretary Christopher, first time I'd ever met Secretary Christopher, and Holbrooke introduced me as the new Balkan director. And at the time, you know, we had a lot of issues to deal with Bosnia, because there was some effort here to lift the arms embargo on Bosnia. And so I had barely spent any time with Ambassador Holbrooke at the time. I had one day on the job kind of studying things. And Holbrooke said to Secretary Christopher, Secretary, you really need to call British Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd. And this was about, you know, coordinating some things on our efforts to keep this arms embargo from being lifted. And Ambassador Holbrooke turned to me and said, "Chris, do some talking points for the secretary." So I had a spiral notebook in my pocket. I just happened to have it, but I also have terrible handwriting, so my main concern was he wouldn't be able to read anything I wrote. So I just thought real fast and real hard, and tore off 5 pages, of which I did in 3 minutes, and gave to Holbrooke, thinking he'd read it and, you know, make some annotations. Just gave it right to the secretary. Tremendous vote of confidence, which I never forgot, which is he trusted me, so I've got to give him my best all the time. And then Secretary Christopher put them all out. Secretary Christopher was a very fastidious man, and he put out these, you know, things torn out of a spiral notebook, and then carefully placed them so each piece of paper was equidistant from the other, and then used his index finger in calling Douglas Hurd to go through every single line as I'd written it. So it was scary. So the point is, you know, you'll be doing some silly job. I mean, in my first assignment, I was in Belgrade. I was a deputy commercial attaché, and but you know, you want to be on your toes for when things happen. And what about the Peace Corps? Well, I earlier this evening I had a dinner in your student center, and I think someone asked me that. And two things I remember very well. I just come out of college. I just graduated from Bowdoin in June, and I was in the Peace Corps in July. And by September, I was in villages in southeast. I remember the name of the village. My first place was a place called Mukundangi. And I'm sitting there. I'd gone into this credit union where I was to check the books to make sure all the money was there. And so I noticed it was a little tiny little building, part of a school complex. And there was a huge, not a huge crowd, but there were 20 people watching me as I was, you know, taking out the books and starting to look to see whether the ledgers were right. And I said, you know, what's the deal here? And the answer was they want to see that all their money was there. They want to make sure that everything was okay with the credit union books. And at that point, I just had this tremendous sense of responsibility, which I really had not felt yet in college. Now, maybe things change, but in those days, I didn't have a great sense of responsibility in college. I sure developed it 2 months later or 3 months later in that little village called Mukundangi. And then the other time, so I really learned that people count on you, and you got to do your best for them. And it's a personal thing. It's a matter of personal pride. You do your best. And the second thing, real quick, was I sort of felt I'd kind of aced the thing. I understood how things were working. And so by that winter, not much of a winter, we're in the tropics, but there was a credit union was having its annual general meeting. There was corruption from the board. I mean, the money was all there, but, the board, I think 6 people had like 60% of the loans of a 600-person credit union or something. So I really excoriated them in front of the annual general membership, and they all thanked me. They said, "Oh, this is excellent. You really looked for things. You really checked. You found things. Thank you." And I said, "So what I've done is I have appointed, for your approval, a new board of directors who will lead us out of this mess." And so I brought my new board of directors, and the way they did votes there was they didn't mark anything or raise their hands. People would just, you know, get up from the ground and go and stand next to the boards of directors who they were voting for. So I had the old guys over here and then my guys over here. And I thought I'd really gotten the best people. And since everyone was in favor of what I'd done to clean up this mess and to fix the loans, you know, I thought this was a slam dunk. Well, they all voted for the old guys. And I suddenly realized I didn't know what was going on in that credit union. I had no idea. And I thought I had understood it, and I didn't. And so that was a sense of humility, that when you come to a place and you think you've got a fix on it, think again, because things can be a lot more complicated. And so, you know, so many times, you see some country which has some miserable leader, and, you know, the first question that many Americans want, you know, they look at some miserable dictator, and the first question, they go, well, how can we get rid of this guy? That should be your second question. Your first question is, why is that guy there? How did that happen? Why is this miserable person running this poor country? And maybe in understanding the dynamics of what got that guy there, you can answer the first question better. So I think I learned at an early age to be a little humble about what you understand about things. And I must tell you very frankly that as you're dealing with North Korea, I mean, I probably know about as much of North Korea. I've met as many North Koreans as anyone has, etc. But I am very humble in my real knowledge of what is going on internally in North Korea. What is the relationship of Kim Jong-il to his military? I ask these questions all the time, just trying to get a sense of it. Because I'm always going back to that Peace Corps experience where I thought I aced it, I thought I understood it, and I didn't understand it. Yeah. Well, you know, they're very different administrations, and certainly I think 9/11 was a game changer in this country. And so you'd have to ask the question, how would the Clinton administration have handled things if the Clinton administration had undergone 9/11? Obviously, both presidents are very different personalities, but I must say, I find, because I've met with both of them on, I won't say many occasions, but enough occasions to, you know, draw some, you know, enough data points to draw a line here. I mean, I find both of them have a real thirst for facts, for information. And, you know, that's something you find, you know, the more you go up in a bureaucracy or something, the more removed you are from really knowing a situation, which is why I asked the Cambodia desk officer, you know, what should we really do? So you get a little frustrated because you always feel that people are telling you, you know, what we ought to do, and you'd like to kind of know the facts yourself. And I noticed in both of our last two presidents this desire to learn more, learn the facts, and to use their own judgments on how to use those facts. Now, I'm not going to stand here in Amherst College and start giving you a scouting report on the two presidents, but I will tell you that in terms of I won't say there's a permanent bureaucracy, but on the other hand, there are certain procedures that are pretty familiar, so it's not as shocking as you might think to go from one administration to the other. You have policy is essentially, let's say you got country X has some sort of problem, and you know, they've cracked down on dissidents or whatever. You might have a initial policy coordinating committee, even at a desk officer level, just to kind of kick around the problem. You might bring in the CIA; they can tell you what they know about it. You might have your embassy send in a cable. That's the exact same thing in either administration. Then you go up, and then finally you have you go to something called a deputies committee. So you get deputies in the various departments: the deputy defense minister, the deputy secretary of state, deputy secretary of treasury, and then finally you go to a principals committee, and they chaired by the national security advisor, and then they make a decision to go to the president. And, you know, that stuff is pretty similar. So I think from, you know, how Clinton would have handled, you know, Iraq, I don't know. But I can tell you that overall, the sort of policy processes are kind of similar. Yeah.
In terms of cooperating with the U.S. to work toward the North Korean disarmament, would you say there's been a significant policy change between the rule of Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao?
I think no. I think they have both Chinese leaders have supported the idea that they should work with the U.S. and to support a multilateral process. This was first discussed between our president, Jiang Zemin, and certainly Hu Jintao has continued that. I think we've done more than maybe Jiang Zemin expected we could do, and I'm very kind of proud of that, actually, because I think it's very important that the U.S. and China work together. You know, there's so many issues in our relationship, so it's very important that when we have common ground, common interests, we should really exploit that common interest. So I think we've done a lot, and I think Jiang Zemin would be pleased if he knew the degree to which we're doing things. And I'm very pleased to see the relationship our president has established with Hu Jintao. You know, when they get on the phone, they discuss real substance. So it's positive. Yes. Yeah. 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 There is a situation where, you know, we talk about ethics. I mean, you know, we have to respond to that. I mean, we have to do something about that. And when you start, you know, if you take the view that when you see one of these terrible moral situations like that, or Rwanda, or in the past, you know, I think it behooves us to, you know, look for policy prescriptions. How can we address it? And unfortunately, when you start stacking up policy options against what is happening, it's difficult. Now, one option was, of course, to get the UN involved. And why do you do that? Because you want to get different countries involved. Because, you know, I think the U.S. is not in a position to send troops to, you know, to a place like Darfur. But some other countries are. And so we need to figure out a multilateral approach. And the UN, I think, was a good approach on that. We've worked with very closely with the new Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon. He's come up with a so-called hybrid force because the Chinese were very concerned about how the Khartoum government was being, you know, their interest, because the Chinese felt that the Chinese are important in this because they're on the Security Council, and they felt that the Khartoum government was of the belief that we're looking to internationalize Darfur for the purpose of removing it from the from Sudan, that is, dismembering Sudan, which is not anyone's policy. But so we've had to work through some very, very difficult multilateral diplomacy to finally get this multilateral force out there. But ultimately, we're going to need, and we, that force is arriving, and some countries have made some real definite contributions. For example, this thing comes up, we find that we don't have helicopter lift for the force. So you go to various countries that you believe have extra helicopters. Can you bring helicopters to Darfur? They say, well, no, our helicopters are all committed in, you know, Georgia. And you go, well, what if we did it for you in Georgia, then you did it, you know, this sort of thing. So we're working the problem. But it sounds terribly diplomatic to talk about working a problem when people are starving and being murdered. And I think we have to find better ways of dealing with this. We have to find ways to deal with these problems. First of all, understanding the nature of the problems, because not every one of these Sudanese rebels is quite the inspiration that some people think they are. So there are a lot of problems there, political problems. So we have to understand that. But in understanding the problems, I'm concerned that we, you know, a lot of people have been killed in the meantime. So I don't have a good answer for you on that. Okay, sure. Yeah.
In your opinion, can you give some indication of what examples we have been studying and should have been?
Well, That's the mischievous question, but I understand what you're saying, what you're asking for, but I think you know what some of those examples are, and I think we have a 200-year history of having one of the most open, free societies in the world, and I think we ought to let people have a look at this society and understand that, you know, that that's a model they can accept, they can take. I don't think we need to, you know, wag our finger and, you know, threaten, you know, sanctions all the time when we can, I think, look in a more positive way. Now, look, I got no problems with sanctions when they work. Many times they don't work. So I think we have to, when we declare sanctions, it should not just be a feel-good exercise. You should be saying, we're looking at these sanctions because we believe this will have an impact on this some terrible regime out there. And if the answer is yes, they will have an impact, fine, we should do that. But I think we need to be careful of not just doing things to make ourselves feel better, but we should be looking to make the situation better. So, sorry, I can't get to the specifics of what you're asking. Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry? Well, there are plenty of cases where diplomacy doesn't work. And anyone who says that diplomacy is a solution for everything, you know, it's not. I mean, diplomats like to, we like to give diplomacy a chance. I think everyone should give diplomacy a chance. I think it should be your first stop. But there are times in which you're dealing with regimes that are so evil and so bent on what they're doing that you have to be prepared to use military force. And there are times when, in being prepared to use military force, diplomacy will work better. And this is where, I mean, if diplomacy can be a stronger instrument if there's a threat of military force behind it. But I would like to see, I think it's very important that people understand that military force should be a last resort, not a first. And I don't think people who run down diplomacy or complain about it and say that it's too slow, et cetera, yeah, it is, but it's a lot better than the alternatives, because when you're into military conflict, you can be into all kinds of imponderables. So, yes. Well, here's my problem. I want to be really frank with you, but let's say I gave you an answer on that. We have journalists here who immediately write down that answer, and then, you know, I'm in the middle of a negotiation. I'm in the middle of a negotiation with the North Koreans. So if I start publicly giving my views on the nature of the regime, you know, what I think of it, et cetera, I guess the question I'm asking myself is, it might help you understand my views, but it would make my job in negotiating with the North Koreans more difficult. So I'm just going to pass. Yes.
This administration has been very aggressive in countering nuclear proliferation, as in the case of North Korea. When will this administration be equally aggressive in promoting and trying to achieve nuclear disarmament, as required under Article 6 of the Nuclear
NPT? Yeah. I think I think it was about a year ago, there was a Wall Street Journal op-ed co-authored by Kissinger, Schultz, Perry, Sam Nunn. And they asked that question. I think a couple of weeks ago, Strobe Talbot, well known to Amherst College, had a FT Financial Times article on precisely that point, saying that a new administration coming in a year from now is going to confront two main issues. One is this issue of global climate change, and understanding that this is a very serious issue that needs to be addressed in an urgent way, and two, dealing with the proliferation question and specifically going at Article 6. I can tell you that the that Article 6 it has not been a priority of the administration. They have the administration I think has worked very hard to try to prevent countries from acquiring nuclear weapons. It's certainly what we're doing in North Korea by diplomatic means. It's what we're trying to do in Iran by diplomatic means. Certainly, it's a the administration has also worked very hard to create a sort of detection architecture through things like the Proliferation Security Initiative to try to constrain the ability of countries to move around to cooperate with each other on nuclear issues. The administration has worked hard to strengthen what's called the Nuclear Suppliers Group to try to make sure that next time North Korea wants to acquire aluminum tubes, it's not going to be so easy. So a lot of efforts the administration has done, but I would not say that Article 6 has been a major focus. But, you know, it may be something that the next administration should look at because we do have a situation where a lot of countries are looking to develop nuclear weapons and use as the excuse that, you know, what gives us the God-given right to have them while they don't have them. I've occasionally had the North Koreans say to me, well, why do you allow India to have nuclear weapons and we don't? And, the quick answer is, Mr. Kim, there is not enough time in the world to explain to you the difference between India and North Korea. This overall issue of nuclear proliferation is indeed one of the issues that any new administration is going to have to face, because it's not going to go away. It's not going to get solved on its own. Yes? And if I can't, I'll have to tell you. In North Korea?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, good. Yeah. 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 It's hard to say. I like to think that the fact that we've worked together with other states, especially China, means they can't kind of pick and choose. So I think we have created a real solidarity among the five countries. That is, when the North Koreans go to the Chinese, the Russians, the U.S., Japanese, they get the same answer. So I think that's been helpful. So there's no there's less of a possibility that they can kind of divide and conquer us, if you will. I think their economic plight has probably worsened, and they have, you know, there are probably some things improving, but I think most economic economists who've looked carefully at it, looking at things like the incidence of drought and floods. You know, part of this is the breakdown and how they're controlling, the fact that they've lost so many trees off of the hills because they lack firewood and things like that. I think they are running into some ecological catastrophes that are causing some of these problems. I also like to think, you'd have to ask them, that they have now developed nuclear weapons and they don't see much benefit from them. And frankly, there are no benefits from nuclear weapons. So we'll see. I think the incentives are there for them to do this, but you know, sometimes countries don't act on their interests. So. They don't what? Yeah, they don't listen very well to others, yeah. Well, you know, we wanted them to give us a full declaration by the end of December. It didn't happen. It didn't happen for some very specific elements that they have so far failed to include, and we've tried to encourage them to include them, and we have a team going in tonight to work some more on that, and you know, we'll have additional teams, and we'll try to get this done. You have to have, deadlines are important. I mean, why does a professor assign a deadline? I mean, can't the professor wait a couple of days? Yeah, probably. But you assign a deadline because, you know, otherwise the students will just take as much time as they want. Sorry, guys, but I have to. We had to set a deadline. But, you know, it doesn't mean we want to walk out of the six-party talks. At some point, if this delay becomes a complete blockage, well, we'll have to assess where we are and have to decide what to do next. But I don't think we're there yet. I think we're continuing to have some discussions, and let's see what happens this week. So maybe, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. And there was no disabling in the 90s. It was just shut down. Yeah. Yeah, anytime you work an agreement, I mean, I have no doubt that the people on our side who tried to do that agreement wanted to get a complete denuclearization. But you get what you can get. I mean, it's a give and take process. Obviously, it would have been good if they'd been able to get to disablement, but the North Koreans were refusing. And it's not because they didn't try. I mean, our side didn't try. They just couldn't get it. So these are negotiated instruments, and you do the best you can. So I'm in no position to criticize. It wasn't that, Bob Gallucci and company didn't think about disablement. You know, they go, oh, disablement, we never thought of that. It's not that at all. It's just, it's a negotiated process. I think it's been helpful that we have all six parties, as I said earlier. I think to work in an overall framework and say to the North Koreans, we need disablement on this one, I think was the way to go. And the team in the 90s didn't have that. Look, if that agreed framework didn't happen, there'd be a lot more North Korean plutonium in the world today. So let's bear that in mind. But, I tell you, when you're in these things, you don't criticize the guy who handled it before, because I can imagine people coming and looking at, what we did in Dayton, for example. People do that all the time. They go, what were they thinking? Or what were they drinking that we have, that they created all these structures where we had, federation parliament and then a Serb parliament and then an overall, three parliaments. I mean, they're having elections. It was like the U.S. primary season. So, you do what the parties negotiate. And so that was the why we did that. And now people look back at Dayton and go, what were they doing? Well, we were doing the best we could. All right.
It's been a very long day. So.